Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 537.1C0618, certificate number 25369. The golden age of porn.
Or prawn, depending on how we title it.
Yeah, what happens if you put the word porn in a podcast episode title?
Well, a lot of the people that listen to this show on the way to school with their kids are probably going to skip ahead.
They're scrambling to re-listen to Balloon Man right now. Kids, did you like Balloon Man?
Let's listen to it again. Let's go all the way back and start over.
Once again, all these good-hearted Americans out there craving a Ken episode. Like, yeah, when will we
I know.
The sweet balm, the sweet wholesome balm of a Ken Jennings show? And they're like, oh. It's a John week.
John show.
More depraved John Roderick material.
I feel like we're in a competition, a race to the bottom to see who can put out a show that the fewest people listen to. you keep doing theoretical math that people are like, skip.
So you're saying your version of theoretical math is vintage porn.
Is vintage porn. That's right. We've done some shows that trended over to the blue. We're a blue. Are we a blue state? No, we're a red state. I never get those right. No, we're a blue state.
There we go.
Because red, if we were the red states, then we would be, that's too communist. So somehow they flipped it.
I think it's an accident.
It was just an accident.
I think it was like one map on ABC one year or something.
And now it's become
stuck.
Enshrined. I want those listeners to Omnibus that are like busy downloading MILF porn or whatever it is, you know.
Finally.
We have a lot of those listeners because we have a lot of listeners, right? Anytime you do a distribution.
And they're not being reached yet. They're like Elf on the Shelf again. When are these guys' kids going to grow up so they can get back to my interests? Hot stepmoms.
You remember back when we used to do video conference calls as part of our Patreon, mm-hmm. right? At a certain level of giving, you were entitled to one 45-minute Zoom call with the two of us.
We still do it, but now it's a recorded message for scheduling reasons. Yeah, we really watered it down.
But in the course of doing those over a couple of years, I really realized how diverse our listenership is based on just like the people that that were at the tier where they got to talk to us.
Some of them are hollow-eyed men in a cabin in Montana. Some of them are hollow-eyed men in a cabin in Pennsylvania. No, that's not true.
But yeah, I figure because this is the show immediately after Valentine's Day, right? The show before Valentine's Day was just some anodyne show about the ancient Greeks.
So can I ask you, so this morning I was like, what's your show going to be? And you said, is it the Valentine's Day show?
Right.
And I said, yeah, kind of. It's the following week. And then you said, I'm doing the golden age of porn.
Yeah.
Now, is that because you realized it was after Valentine's Day, so it couldn't be a romantic show? Or is this your idea of a romantic Valentine's Day omnibus?
How many people do you think break up on Valentine's Day?
Oh, wow.
I mean, New Year's Eve is a good time to like ruin your marriage, have your marriage end as a result of some, not something you did, but some kind of big, in that moment.
Just a drunken blow up or like
I feel like the moment of New Year's Eve is a moment where you either stare into your beloved's eyes and say, to the next year.
I'm going to re-up. Auto renewal
right.
of Hulu.
Or you stare into one another's eyes and you go, what are we doing? I definitely broke up with someone on New Year's Eve, and I know one marriage that ended on New Year's Eve.
Mm.
So every New Year's Eve, it's coming, you know, for us on this side of New Year's Eve, it's coming. I would guard your marriage, Ken.
I'm pretty worried now.
Yeah.
Send us your tales of New Year's breakups as a cautionary tale to me.
Maybe,
in particular.
Maybe what you should do, if you feel like your relationship is a little unstable, go to bed at 9. Say, you know what, honey? Let's just go to bed at 9.
That would preserve my marriage, because that is Mindy's ideal New Year's Eve.
Exactly.
As if we were to go to bed at 9.
And then you wake up the next morning and you're like, whew,
we made it. Y2K didn't happen for our marriage.
But I feel like Valentine's Day is, you know, it's a high-pressure situation. A lot of relationships probably end there. And the week following Valentine's Day, there's probably a renewed interest in
pornography.
In MILF porn, right.
Do you think we could see this? Like, is there a chart where we could see pornography use ticking up in certain, like, say, after a certain election?
Let's see.
I am not looking this up, by the way.
Yeah, well, you're just trying to keep your search history clean.
Yeah, I don't need to clean out my browser results after every omnibus, do I?
Do you must have a secret account in some old computer that is just for watching porn in the garage.
No, it's for looking up academic research on porn demographics.
Right. Well, porn actually does have peak times of year.
Hmm.
The thing is, my computer is from 2014. It has every single, I mean, when I log on to the internet, the internet is like, oh, do you want to watch more cow hoof trimming videos? And I'm like, no, not today. Thank you, internet. And they're like, want to see guys do skateboard tricks where they slide down railings and halfway down, like, fall off the skateboard and land on their midsection? And I'm like, no, not today, internet.
Internet's really trying to make you happy, and you're just like Charlie Brown.
I'm like, no.
Not even that.
I'm trying to look
not
up
even that
porn.
Will cheer
God,
me up
would
today.
You stop? And they're like, are you sure you don't want to see people like crash hilariously on mountain bikes? No, thank you. But people do tend to peak watching porn, or rather, that's a weird sentence.
Don't say that.
They're not peaking while they're watching porn, although some small number of people on mushrooms watching porn, which not recommend.
I was thinking of a different meaning of
peak. Oh, peak. You meant P-E-E-K.
Well, I meant P-E-A-K, but in a different sense.
Oh, I see. Right. There's so many ways you could say peaking
close
on porn.
Close to the end of their viewing, I'm sure many of them.
Are peaking.
Yeah. I didn't even like saying that this was an entry.
Oh, yeah.
This week.
It's so many.
Look what you've done.
So many.
Look what you've done.
Double, triple, quadruple entendre. But yes, people watch porn in winter, which I think is maybe.
It's the coziest genre.
Yeah, somewhat obvious. But then they also watch it in late summer.
Late summer.
And as someone who has had, you know, I think maybe more relationships than you, although it's not a race, it's not a comparison.
I would assume so. Yeah, no. And if it is, fewer probably wins, honestly.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, maybe. Maybe according to your moral compass. But I tended to get into relationships in spring and fall.
Oh, you think that's when people are unattached, summer and winter?
Well, I don't know if you get into relationships just because other people are unattached. No, I think it's because you're seeking something. In the spring, you're seeking some kind of renewal. Pollen? Yeah, pollen. You're seeking pollen. You know, the birds and the bees.
The trees are smelling weird. You're like, I got to get out there.
And then in the fall, it's such a romantic time. Mm. But you don't want to start a relationship in midwinter. And I don't think so in midsummer.
But you're saying the poor numbers are higher because people are unattached in those months.
Oh, I see what you're saying. That's the theory behind doing this show right after Valentine's Day.
Sure.
Is that you've had, you know, a few days for the relationship to be over and a lot of angry texts.
But what if relationships begin on Valentine's Day? I guess they don't.
What kind of weird relationship would begin on Valentine's
Day? It's true. It would involve a Valentine's Day first date.
Can you imagine?
That's a lot of...
It happens.
It must happen.
It happens.
I mean, there's a lot of pressure out there, a lot of cultural pressure.
Yeah.
To be coupled on Valentine's Day, so it must happen.
I feel like it's a plot of a 30 Rock episode where accidentally... It is. It's the
guy who's only seen 30 Rock. This reminds me of a 30 Rock episode.
The only show I've ever watched. It feels, I think the John Hamm era, you know, whatever, however long that lasted on 30 Rock. I think their first date was Valentine's Day. Accidentally. Completely accidentally.
I want a parallel universe where you've only seen the sitcom Benson and everything reminds you of an episode of Benson.
I did watch Benson its era. I loved Benson. And Benson was a spinoff show of...
Soap,
which was a little bit harder of a watch for me.
Well, I think
that
it was
Billy Crystal's star vehicle,
it
was, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, he was in it. I think of it as a Katherine Hellman video.
Sure, sure.
Or a vehicle. But yes, it was kind of a satire of primetime Dallas type shows. I can see why it wouldn't work for a Gen X kid. I never watched it.
Because I didn't watch Dallas. And so getting a spoof of Dallas.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, it was sort of SCTV era where a lot of the SCTV stuff, you would think I would have been prime SCTV watcher, but I didn't. It compared unfavorably with Saturday Night Live for me.
But in our universe, you're a 30 Rock fan. And let's get back to colindrical porn.
Oh, you want to go back to porn. Okay. All right, Ken.
Yeah, why are we talking about Benson?
When you brought up
Benson.
When there's a
wide world of lasciviousness and debauchery.
So I should say to our listeners, we're in a different bunker. We've transferred bunkers.
It can't be, yeah. Can you really transfer bunkers? I mean, your life is okay if you keep moving bunkers.
We've had only, how many bunkers have we had? We've had three bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we have done, only a couple of times have we done shows
elsewhere.
Yeah,
like my house.
Or like we've done them live.
Live, that's
and
true.
And on a cruise ship.
But this and our most recent bunker are kind of subterranean.
These are truly bunkers.
So it's a good vibe.
There's actually like a real bunker here.
I know. You weren't tempted to move us in there?
I don't think we would like it in there.
All the spiders and... And mason jars of preserves from the 80s?
I've taken all the spiders out. I'm pretty on top of those. But I mean, there are literally bunk beds in there. I think it would remind us of our... But you know...
What if we did the show each lying in a different bunk bed, just kind of talking with the lights out?
If we need the bunker, it's right there. Like if the skies suddenly turn red,
yeah,
we could both retreat in there, although I bet you would be bummed.
Well, yeah.
He'd be like...
Unlike most people who would be happy in the face of an imminent cataclysm. I guess you.
I'd be fine, but you would be stuck with me. That's what I mean.
I'm looking at your books right now. Yeah. It's a bit of a downgrade for me.
Oh.
We have a lot of overlap.
Yeah, but your books are all comic books. These books have real words in them.
They are not all comic
books. These are
books.
word books, not picture
just,
books.
I actually just saw upstairs, you own a comic book that I have, and I was like, why is John reading Box Office Poison by Alex Robinson?
Why wouldn't I?
You've probably never read it. It just sits there.
I've read it.
It just sits there.
No.
I'm looking at, so what am I going to read? A Practical Guide to Racism by C.H. Dutton. Is that a how-to?
Yeah, know thy enemy, Ken. Well, anyway, so what inspired me to do the show today was...
I don't want to know.
I've been meaning to do swingers clubs.
Oh, yeah.
And
then do an omnibus about them?
I don't think that I'm the right market for swingers clubs. And I think partly it is, as in all sort of sex-related and even not sex-related, just sort of club-related.
Yeah, are you there for the world. Sex or there for the club?
Well, the all that stuff, there are a lot more single men that want to be members than there are either couples or single ladies. All the single ladies.
The unicorns, they call them.
Yeah, but even not all the single ladies. Like, I think this is true on the dating apps. There are just so many more single men that that they have to set limits, or they have to say, like, women get in free. A lot of the singles clubs, a lot of the swingers clubs actually had requirements that men be accompanied by a lady.
Because otherwise you're just clogging up their joint.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a little double entendre too.
No, it's not.
I'm so sorry to the listeners that were like, I'm going to listen to this with my teens. It should be educational.
I'll keep an open mind.
It's not going to be educational.
Well, it'll be educational about something.
Yeah, that's right. Educational about the different ways that Ken can make accidental double entendre.
So what you're saying is because you're not allowed in swingers clubs.
Right. Well, I would not be, I'm not the audience for that because I don't know. I feel like exhibitionism isn't like a massive
thing. It's still a thing right?
For me.
There is a Seattle orgy scene.
There is.
I believe.
There is.
This is third hand when it gets to me. But
yeah, where are you learning about that?
Just like
overhearing stuff at Starbucks,
yeah,
or?
Just in the aisles of Trader Joe's. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you go to bookstores, and bookstores are full of creeps.
Oh, is that where those guys are?
Well, no, but you can hear creeps talking
to each
other.
I'm in cheery Seattle independent bookstores full of
cats,
full of moms crocheting,
smarty pants. But no, there are creeps there too. You just have to learn to identify them.
I'm going around the aisles listening for the.
But there are a lot of different kinds of clubs. One thing about having actual sex is that you need to do it with someone else. You can't do it at home unless you're married.
And you said this wasn't going to be educational.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There are kids listening, you know, Gen Millen, or as we say, or Gen Alpha, who are like, wait a minute, you have to do sex with other people?
They're taking notes. No, like, they do not want sex content.
No, they don't. They don't at all.
They've all noped out. Only Gen X is left. We've created a safe space
with
the specter of sex.
When we talked about Tom of Finland on an earlier episode that a lot of people punched out of early.
Is that true?
If they were driving their kids to school. There was a, pornography is ancient, of course. There are all the terracotta pots with Greeks and Etruscans.
And there's sutras.
Yeah,
there's temple walls lined with
that's right.
All kinds of shenanigans.
Like throughout the East, lots and lots of sexy content. But sexy content on film, as you can imagine, was one of the first applications of film that people could, people were like, what would I do with a camera? let's see.
There was that movie of the train pulling into the station, and a lot of people were like, oh, is that a metaphor?
So in the first kind of thing that made printing photographs cheap enough to, you know, actually make it a viable form, like in newspapers, was the development of halftone printing, where gradations of gray were accomplished by using different sized dots. If you look at a black and white photograph, it's not there. There's only black and white, but depending on how small or large the dots are,
people who grew up with printing maybe didn't even think about this, but that did not come out of the faucet that way. The existing means of printing did not allow you to put photographic stuff on paper,
right?
Because
how do you grayscale?
That's why books had like those tipped in color inserts for so long, because there was no way to put photography in the book proper with the same printing tech.
Yeah, it's why the same halftone printing is used in color too, because there are really only the three colors and but different size dots, you know, to the eye, it blends together.
So you look at a newspaper photo close up, you'll see the. Is that still true? Yeah, that's still true.
Yeah.
How else would you do it?
You're
not putting, 50 Shades of Gray in your or even the book 50 Shades of Gray.
You got it. You brought us back around to porn.
To me, that's erotica.
Oh, sure, erotica. Well, that will come into the conversation. But halftone printing.
What she said.
Oh, halftone print. Where's my bell? Oh, the bunker doesn't have a bell. Oh, we do have the ship's bell.
Thong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Halftone printing made it possible to do cheaper, like, printed porn. But really, one of the first, I mean, porn was one of the first applications for motion pictures. There were already stag films in the teens. Famously,
The 19 teens, I hope you mean.
The 19-teens. Okay. In 1915, there was a kind of what's regarded as maybe the first real porn movie. It was called A Free Ride, or A Grass Sandwich.
A grass sandwich,
and it was a great story. I mean, most porn films were short. It's a great story of a man in a fancy car who happened to be wearing a large fake mustache. Picked up two hitchhikers who were, you know, two comely ladies. And
I think I see where this is going.
Yeah, and then he stopped because he had to pee, and they snuck out of the car to watch him.
Tee-hee.
And then they both needed to pee, and he snuck over and watched them.
The very first porn movie is like pee stuff?
Yeah, there's...
Is this in Germany?
They're not doing it on each other or to each other, but it's the act of watching somebody pee that excites their... it titillates them.
Their World War One era.
That's right.
Wow. So
even before the war, and then they, you know, and then they, I guess they have a grass sandwich.
Whatever that. Do you think that was a phrase at the time, or did you think this
is this
movie,
like, oh, you kid?
Yeah. Did this movie coin the phrase grass sandwich?
I don't know. I've never heard it. I've never heard it before. And I haven't seen the film, but in reading the description of it, I couldn't quite figure out like what made the. How grass played into the sandwich?
I guess because it's outdoors. That's a little transgressive at the time.
That's right. In the open air.
Do you think the guy has a fake mustache on so he won't get recognized?
Well, this is the thing about stag films, and we talked about stag films in a gay context during the.
I don't remember. Hanky Codes, Tom of Finland.
It was Tom of Finland show, but stag films were always a very popular kind of attraction at fraternity parties, at Elks clubs, and they were very much like a public, like a community building thing, where they would,
that's what you would want for porn. You'd want a bunch of other dads with beers in the room.
They were almost always silent films, even into the 50s and 60s.
Oh, so you could Mystery Science Theater them.
That's exactly what
people
did.
Would hoot and holler.
A bunch of guys in the fraternity basement, and they would watch the grass sandwich, as we now say. And they would, you know, the funny guys would provide a running commentary.
So it makes it slightly more wholesome because you're not alone in your room like a guy in a dirty bookstore.
Right. No, you're with your
friends kind of having a laugh, like, look at this kind of silly stuff. What would the wife think of this?
And there was a lot of in those stag movies, a lot of kind of comedy, intentional, like spoofing, a lot of fake mustaches, because there was and all in stag there were no credits, right? There was no copyright. None of the actors or actresses wanted to be identified, but even pseudonyms, they didn't. There was no, it just, the movie started, and when it ended, it ended.
So there must have been, I mean, there must have been a way to monetize this stuff at first, even if weird, unauthorized dupes of it play forever, thanks to some creepy guy with access to a chem lab.
Yeah, you would be selling them. There wasn't any
some mail order.
You're not getting residuals. Right. Exactly. As an actor, you're not opening up your SAG.
The residuals might be a rash.
Yeah. Yeah. They would even mail order. It would have been this would have been part of the obscenity question using the U.S. mails. So they had
right. Comstock Act didn't get defanged until 20th century. Right. So,
well, this is all happened. Most of this is happening in the 20th century.
But I'm just saying that it might have still been going, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know whenever those landmark cases, the D.H. Lawrence or whatever, whenever those happened, but they probably went into the 40s and 50s, right?
Yeah, well, it was illegal to mail contraceptives into the 70s, but the Comstock Act...
And it may be again soon. Who knows?
Well, that's the thing. It has recently started to play into it's what they call a zombie law. There are provisions of it that make it illegal to mail, contraceptives or drugs related to abortion. And as different states in the country start to outlaw abortion, then
this Comstock law
comes into effect.
This is the executive branch lever that could effectively ban abortion nationwide,
right?
If it were enforced.
Yes, right. So a lot of these, a lot of the obscenity rulings, and as we'll see, obscenity rulings have gone through a lot of permutations, and they bounce down to states, people file suit, then makes its way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court kind of has been amending various statutes for...
They say they know it when they see it.
Years and years.
But do they?
That comes
up
too.
I mean, it's culturally mediated. It's definitely going to change over generations.
Well, for some, there are
well, it could shift either way, I guess.
Some people that are still using 17th century definitions of obscenity.
Yeah, I mean, Fanny Hill is still in print. You know, the porn from that era is as popular as ever.
Some of the people that have 17th century moralities are sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court even as we speak.
How many Catholics can you get on a 9-person Supreme Court? 10? 11? 15? We don't know.
Now, listen, this is not going to be an anti-Catholic show. And one of the reasons I didn't do swinger clubs is that swinger clubs, trended into the early, and by early, I mean, we're talking about the late 60s now, when there was a sudden kind of explosion of acceptability in porn. We talked about this on Tom of Finland. There was, an increasing willingness on the part of actual artists to engage with sexuality in terms that made it, that really pushed the idea of, does this have artistic merit? Mm-hmm. Does this fall under the First Amendment? But also with the advent of the pill, a lot of liberalizing, as a fallout of kind of the 50s Playboy, the obscenity charges around comedians, Lenny Bruce. I mean, there was a cultural momentum that was trying to, I think, liberalize across a wide variety of, as you said, I mean, the obscenity laws were applied to literature in the
early part of the 20th century. are against James Joyce and D.H. Lawrence novels.
Exactly.
You know, the stuff on the fringes that maybe didn't have the artistic value, porn, benefited in the slipstream.
But all of the, and a lot of this was centered in New York City. In fact, New York City, I mean, the first full-length porn movies actually were published in the United States before the first country in Europe legalized porn, and that was Denmark. We think of the Danes or Scandinavians or Europeans in general as having a much more liberal idea of what...
open-minded, sex-positive.
That's right. And the Danish legalized porn as a way of, kind of like the Dutch legalized marijuana, as a way of bringing it into the open air.
Getting the vice elements out of it.
Yeah, and with the idea that it would actually reduce its use because the appeal of it as a transgression would kind of fade. I mean, if you think about marijuana in the Netherlands, typically marijuana is a tourist activity. I mean, the Dutch that smoke marijuana are the ones that smoke marijuana, but the vast majority of Dutch people aren't interested in marijuana and kind of think of it as not a vice, but just a sort of...
But does that work for sex?
Well, no, although what we're seeing on the internet now is a real trend toward kink, because...
Is that right? I guess I see that when they show the maps. What every state is, what porn every state is Googling or whatever, and you're like, really?
Yeah, and I
bondage,
think it, I think it's because there's so much porn on the internet, and it is so, I mean, there's so much of it that it started to become siloed, like, oh, you're just into straight.
Now people can specialize.
Missionary. But it's harder and harder to be transgressive, and there is an element of sex that it's the transgression that appeals to people.
Right.
Because normal, healthy, and by healthy, I mean healthy in the health science class sense, but, you know, like procreative sex, like not only is it boring, but it feels, I mean, it's not boring. Listen. It can be very exciting.
What's the Woody Allen joke? Everyone I've had was right on the money.
But it almost ends up being a kind of part of the contemporary conversation around inclusiveness.
And for whatever reason, part of the psyche wants something weirder in many cases.
Yeah. In the late 60s, people started pushing the boundaries of what could be published in magazines, what could be shown on film. And there were a lot of sort of early, if you think about those early Playboys, they're really just topless models. There's no, you know, there's nothing below the waist, really. But in New York City in particular, there were a lot of peep shows that started to play stag films as commercial material in Times Square in little 50-seat theaters.
Right.
And as the kind of center of this explosion, if you will, in culture, Greenwich Village and Times Square, there were quite a few people that were using the artistic merit, using the First Amendment as ways to publish what would become, or what you would call, explicit material that involved actual sex visible to
genitalia, hardcore pornography.
That's right. Al Goldstein and his magazine Screw.
The subtly titled magazine. Subtly,
I mean, Al Goldstein really was an innovator in this space. He had a magazine called Gay. He was somebody who was really, really trying to ultimately profit from...
Yeah, it's a big audience.
Yeah, it's
the Republicans Buy Sneakers 2 theory.
Gay
porn.
They had a real hard time expanding outside of New York City. It was hard to mail this stuff
in Connecticut. Nobody wants that.
And he attempted to open clubs and start magazines in other parts of the country, and even in Los Angeles, his businesses all failed. Other people came in. Larry Flint came in and basically duplicated the whole vibe of Al Goldstein's Screw and somehow managed to make it a national magazine.
Al was just ahead of his time.
Al was ahead of his time. And because Larry Flint came in after what we're going to talk about now, which is the golden age of porn. It may surprise you and many of our listeners who are still tuned into the show, who haven't pulled over to the side of the road and started crying, that the first full-length porn film that depicted actual intercourse for a mainstream audience was made by Andy Warhol.
Oh, right.
As part of his factory community of artists. Andy had, in 1964, made a couple of films, one called Eat, where he filmed his friend Robert Indiana.
The artist. Previously on Omnibus fame because of his Love's statue, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
Robert Indiana.
And now he's eating.
What's he
eating? Pastrami on rye.
He starred in the film Eat, which was just him eating. I've never seen it, so I'm not sure what he was eating. But it was a meal. He ate a full meal.
Spaghetti and meatballs? Hard to say. We don't know.
Let's see. What was Robert Indiana eating?
Let's see what Google AI tells you when you ask, what was Robert Indiana eating?
Well, let's see if I...
It was too early for tacos.
Oh, wait. There's been a new movie called Eat from 2014.
Is it a sequel?
I can't believe that you would call your movie Eat after... Andy Warhol had already... Yeah,
it's category killer, right?
Yeah, like, right.
If anybody's going to rent Eat, they're going to watch 45 minutes of Robert Indiana eating. Oh, I have it. Do you know what he's eating?
What is he eating? Mushrooms?
A mushroom.
Oh, he eats a mushroom.
Yeah, very slowly, apparently. I feel like I could eat a mushroom in less than 45 minutes. Like, I could eat a mushroom right now in 44 minutes, and I wouldn't even break a sweat. Even if it was one of those big ones, even like a portobello.
Currently on IMDb, the movie Eat... with Robert Indiana has a 3.6 out of 10 rating. So not super fascinating.
Nobody's favorite. And I'm sure it's hard to see. I'm sure it's the kind of thing you have to wait for the moment of screen.
Oh, I bet you the whole movie is like right up inside Robert Indiana. You know, we should have an omnibus film festival where all the movies we've talked about, I guess every show has a movie in its secret code.
Except for this episode. We cannot show all the movies we're talking about today.
Yeah, I guess not. But Warhol made another movie called Sleep,
right,
where John Giorno just sleeps.
Well, why did he get rid of Robert Indiana? Man, do you think they had a falling out, or maybe his sleeping audition just wasn't as good? Like,
it might have been.
That John Giorno guy, that guy could sleep.
Well, no, John Giorno was Andy Warhol's boyfriend. Mm. So Andy probably had more exposure to him.
More access.
He didn't need to audition. Andy saw him every night or afternoon.
I've seen him sleep. He's a solid sleeper.
He's a good sleeper. I'm just going to turn the camera on. And so Andy had always wanted, these movies were made in 64. Andy always wanted to make a movie with another four-letter word.
Even though neither eat or sleep are four letters.
Yeah, that's right. The average of them
is four letters.
What I meant was word, another one-word title.
One-syllable Anglo-Saxon word.
Yeah. And he felt like maybe that was a little too...
Right.
A little too much.
I mean, a lot of fans of the trilogy would probably just nope out right there. They'd be like, I love to eat.
Yep.
Sleep was a little slow, but boy, whoa, what a twist here in part three.
I think everybody likes to do the third thing too.
Right, but you can't take your family to watch it.
No, that's right. But Warhol filmed what he, you know, the working title was F**CK. In the current parlance.
Literally, no. It's 26 things it could be.
So do you know, Andy's movie was called Blue Movie. Do you know where the origin of blue as a term for like ribald story comes from?
I mean, this might be the first time a blue movie is a pornographic movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I think blue might have already meant dirty because of comedians that would work blue.
That's right.
There's different versions of this. I think there's somebody who had, you know, family jokes on one color card and then the naughty jokes on different color cards so he could tell at a glance.
You mean a comedian? A comedian on stage.
Yeah, like Borscht Belt. You know, he could tell at a glance whether he was working from the right deck for the 9 o'clock show or not.
The first published instance of a blue story being called that is as long ago as 1890.
Oh, wow.
So even before, really...
Before there was pornography.
Before
genitals existed.
But the reason Warhol's movie was called Blue Movie is when he was filming it, he used a certain film stock that was geared to being for outdoor filming, but he used it inside and it produced a blue tint to the film. And when he watched it, when he screened it for the first time, he said, "Why is it blue?" And some, you know, fellow filmmaker was like, "Oh, well, you used the wrong film stock." And he said, "Well, I guess we'll call it Blue Movie."
There we go.
Yeah.
It's not a bug. It's a feature.
It's not a bug. It's a feature. And of course, I mean, at this point, Warhol had his own movie theater in Greenwich Village on Bleecker Street called the Garrick Theater, where he showed all of his own, you know, his own films. And so he premiered Blue Movie at the Garrick, which is a, you know, it's a small theater. Yeah, the Garrick Theater is still there in New York. And the thing is, I've walked by it 1,000 times. And, well, the crazy thing about Greenwich Village is you walk down the street and every single place has some incredible history in American artistic life.
Bob Dylan performed here.
Yeah, but every Stonewall's one of them now, here. They're all just selling T-shirts and snow cones.
Correct.
And so you don't have a, you don't, unless you're carrying a guidebook that's like, and now.
Or you recognize it from an album cover.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But the movie's 105 minutes long. It features unsimulated sex. And
it seems long. It seems on the long side to me.
Well, because it's also, there's other things going on, although it's mostly improvised. And the sex is actually pretty casual. It stars Viva, who was one of Warhol's muses.
She's a model?
Yeah, and a kind of, you know,
factory girl.
Factory girl. And Louis Walden, who went on to, I mean, both Viva and Louis Walden went on to be actors in other films.
Adult film stars or like?
No, they appear, I mean, Louis Walden appears in Taxi Driver.
Huh.
I mean, they're bit players.
They're just like on the New York scene. Films.
Yeah. A Blue Movie was released June 12th, 1969.
Nice.
Yeah, that's right. And that is just 2 weeks before Denmark legalized pornography. So Warhol, ahead of the curve.
69 is the same year that like Midnight Cowboy wins Best Picture. So a movie about kind of the sleazy side of New York sex work, which gets an X rating to indicate that it's not for families.
Right.
Like literally wins Best Picture. Hollywood's changing too.
Well, and this Blue Movie we'll see it really affects Hollywood in the early 70s. Blue Movie cost $3,000 to make, and Warhol grossed $3,000 kind of on opening night at the Garrick Theater. And so he, you know, it was obviously profitable.
Yeah.
And I think the sex kind of had a like enough of a lighthearted air that people walked out of the theater feeling pretty charmed by it.
Did it also have plot? Like 105 minutes.
Like, did any Warhol movie really have plot?
Right. Is it basically just mushroom eating, but
yeah,
for almost 2 hours?
There are lots of, I mean, everything that they did there felt pretty tossed off. But it had an air of, I mean, everybody.
It's an art installation more than a narrative.
Yeah,
right?
And they knew one another, right? It was a comfortable place. The sex probably was part of what was happening anyway.
Right.
But on July 31st, the police raided the Garrick Theater, arrested all of the staff, and the manager was fined $250 for obscenity.
New York still had laws against this thing.
New York still had laws. Now, so the film only had 10 minutes of actual sex in its 110-minute runtime. Warhol kind of famously believed that actual conversation, sort of My Dinner with Andre level of just conversation, was way more interested than scripted conversation. I don't know if you concur.
Well, I'm on a podcast right now. Apparently, I think that improvised conversation is the highest art form.
Yeah, that's right. I believe it is too. So there it is. It's
people are not going to believe this. This is not a little written one act play.
Confirmed.
With arcs and falling action and epiphanies.
So when the police raided the Garrick, it went before a New York criminal court, and they found that it was obscene. And in his defense, the manager and Warhol both said, "Who is harmed by, you know, the making of this film?" And they started, I guess you could say they became kind of high profile advocates for the liberalization of the obscenity laws to include, I mean, sex would have appeared in this film as a natural offshoot of what would be the
conversation,
the other 100 minutes of people just doing their normal
just
behavior.
Like it never does in most podcasts.
Warhol,
what if every podcast turned into like just 10 minutes of explicit sex at some point? What a surprise that would be.
I mean, this podcast would be unlistenable.
It would really change Omnibus quite a bit, but other podcasts probably more.
Right. I mean, I think
This American Life would be very odd.
All those murder podcasts, I would suddenly be interested in them. So there were kind of in the immediate aftermath, a little spate of porn films that became caused celebs in the New York literary scene. Because Warhol already had such a reputation, the movie was reviewed by Ebert. You know, there was a sort of serious, at least critical interest in it as a work of art. Ebert didn't like it.
Thumbs down.
Thought it was boring. And it probably was. But there was then a gay pornographic film called Boys in the Sand that also had, in this case, maybe more of a plot, a right. narrative, like a boy goes down into the sand. I mean, it was, you know, filmed in...
There's going to be a sand sandwich.
Yeah, that's right. Sand sandwich. Filmed on the beach, and there was, how did he get here? Oh, my goodness. And that played at the 35th Street Playhouse in New York. This was in 71. And again, was treated somewhat as a legitimate, maybe not a thing that you would go to see with your family, clearly. But it was, there were a lot of theaters off-Broadway and off-Broadway that were doing more edgy material at this point. And this was... The Boys in the Sand and the Blue Movie were treated kind of more in that vein.
Like cultural events. Even though in Times Square, people are watching peep shows with maybe just occasional vice busts. Like it's a high-profile thing like this that actually goes to court.
Yeah, there were people in black leotards who were at a theater one block away doing shows about Vietnam that would have also probably trended toward obscenity, but it was New York and Times Square... kind of had special dispensation, but it became a conversation happening in the cultural elite. A lot more people were talking about these films than ever went to see them. And because the First Amendment was a hot topic, there was a lot of advocacy for porn that stretched to people that wouldn't have otherwise supported it.
Yeah, you get First Amendment absolutists saying, hey, I would, you know, the same way that ACLU is like, we don't want to defend the Illinois Nazis, but we're gonna. You get a lot of people saying, hey, porn's bad, but we have a First Amendment for a reason.
Casting back to Oscar Wilde, who by this point in time had been completely rehabilitated, and those prosecutions and all those literary prosecutions were seen as unjust, and those books no longer scandalized.
Yeah.
There was a sense, and we see it today in the critical consensus. There is a lot of critical advocation for things that are done on the grounds of acceptance and inclusion.
You're going to say done on the ground.
And they're done down on the ground.
Yeah, like a grass sandwich.
It's a grass sandwich. The real turning point came in 1972 with...
Your birth. No way, you're 69.
No, I'm from 68.
Oh, wow.
I'm before all this. I'm from a clean country.
You're watching with interest as a four-year-old.
Yeah, you come into this clean country in your silk suits. That was me before the moon landing. And one could argue that the Saturn V rocket is just, I mean, that all that footage is really just a porn movie.
Right.
Right. I mean, we're penetrating the heavens with our,
did the rocket,
big phallus.
I mean, the rocket probably had to be phallic. It probably was not a, it's not a design choice.
I mean, the UFOs are all shaped like Frisbees. So there's right. got to be, what's going on with them?
But the UFOs are somehow escaping, they're reaching escape velocity.
Via other means.
Through mysterious means that we don't have to figure out.
Photon drives. Well, they're probably all constructed in space. That's how UFOs are designed.
I'm just saying, like, even if there's some parallel matriarchy running a space program in the late 60s, I don't know what a vaginal rocket looks like.
Hmm. Well, here, tricky. I've got a pencil and a piece of paper.
Let's see if we can get to work on this.
So Deep Throat...
Deep
Throat was released in June of 72. June seems to be the time where porno movies are released.
Despite your theories about how early summer pales next to late summer.
Blue Movie came out on June 12th, 69. Deep Throat came out on June 12th, 1972.
I mean, it is tentpole movie season.
Mm-hmm.
For any definition of tentpole.
It starred Linda Lovelace, and it had a plot as maybe tenuous a plot as it is. It was like a scripted film.
Mm.
Linda Lovelace as an actor over the course of her life has published four different autobiographies.
From her Christian era, her post-Christian era.
Yeah, and there were, you know, in her early ones, she was a strong advocate of the film and everything that it wrought. In her later era, she published two more autobiographies that claimed that she was coerced.
Right.
And that that she was raped in the process of making the film.
Not impossible, right? I mean,
not impossible at all.
I'm sure there was trafficking and borderline trafficking in a lot of these filmmaking enterprises at the time.
And her husband was present on the set and by all accounts was, you know, kind of coercive and violent.
Oh, really?
Threatening.
Like he's also her manager and
exactly.
her pimp.
But the film was an enormous success. And when you look at the books, the film was really funded by, I guess, what you would describe as the Columbo crime family.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so the mob got into producing porn right at the beginning. And you have to think that the mob was already producing stag films. It was something that kind of went hand in hand with...
But they're also a forward-thinking people.
Yeah, that's
right. They're hardy immigrants.
That's right. I mean,
they're always looking at the next horizon.
The mob is gone now, and everyone is perfectly assimilated, and you know, like high fives all around. But the mob was deeply involved in prostitution, and you have to assume that a lot of the stag films were the products of.
Right. You're not holding open auditions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you have a stable of workers.
But they funded. They funded the movie. It cost $22,000 to make, so quite a jump from Warhol's $3,000 Blue mm-hmm. movie. And some would argue, I mean, there are studies, because Deep Throat has come under tremendous critical study. And there are some people who have said, or some figures that indicate that over the course of its now 50-year run in the across all formats of media mm-hmm. that it has earned over $600 million. Now
let's be clear, it's a seminal work.
It is a seminal work. It could only have come from you. I think more conservative estimates take into consideration that because it was often screened in mob theaters or theaters that had connections to organized crime, and it was funded by the mob, that it was also used as a money laundering scheme, and figures were inflated.
In order to launder more money.
In order to launder more money. So the $600 million figure is disputed by almost everyone, but even the conservative estimates say that on a $22,000 investment, the movie netted over $100 million.
It's a nine-figure profit. Well, yeah. How can we afford not to make porn?
Well, right.
I guess, let me ask you this. So this is kind of the moment when in cultural history that I'm aware of that, you know, Mr. and Mrs. America decide to go see a porno, teehee, you know, mm-hmm. and not a stag film, but like Deep Throat. So they're going to, are local theaters playing this? Like if you live in Milwaukee or Portland, Oregon, you can go see Deep Throat?
Well, as it went across the country, there were numerous obscenity busts, uh-huh. and all of it fueled the publicity of Deep Throat to the point that Johnny Carson mentioned it on his in his monologue. And the New York Times wrote a 5-page article on what they termed porn chic, because all of the big celebrities now were going to see Deep Throat, and Martin Scorsese went to see Deep Throat and praised it. Again, Ebert was a little bit of a stick in the mud. He said, if this is the effort that has to go into sexual liberation, maybe it's not worth the effort.
Is this that's good. Is this before or after Ebert wrote the screenplay to like Beyond the Valley of the Dolls? Like he dabbled in Russ Meyer era softcore, right?
Yeah, you know, he saw the benefit of trash, but not quite to the level. I mean, I don't think he objected to it on obscene grounds. He objected to it because the acting was stilted and the plot was boring and dumb.
I wish it had come out late enough for him and Siskel to fight about it.
I know.
Siskel's I thought she was very good. I thought she had a very natural quality.
I like your Siskel.
I don't have a Gene Siskel impression.
I mean, one of the things that promoted it was that Al Goldstein's Screw magazine, which was in New York, like a really, it was a cultural force. And Al Goldstein's review of Deep Throat said that he had never been so moved by a film. And so it became one of these where people were talking about the reviews of the movie as much as the movie. Yeah. It gathered steam. It was...
And you get think pieces about the phenomenon, you know, yeah. that are not about the movie. But what does it mean that this movie is catching on?
Yeah, and why is Jack Nicholson going to see it? I mean, now yeah. I really want to see it. And it was often relegated to the theater on the edge of town, or almost always at first. But the more people went to it, you know, the more it became available. And it spawned.
There we go.
A whole series in 72 and 73 of big, they weren't a series, but I'm saying that, you know, there were, people recognized that this was a new art form, and started making feature-length, plot-driven pornographic films. What's interesting is that the movie came out on June 12th, 1972, and 5 days later, June 17th, 1972, the Watergate burglars,
If they had just gone to a dirty movie instead, history could have been so different.
Well, no, what happened was the FBI agent Mark Felt, who ended up informing Woodward and Bernstein, was coined Deep Throat by Ben Bradley, because that was really of the moment.
He was a deep background source. Right. I remember in the movie, in All the President's Men, they make a little joke of it, like they're calling him Deep Throat. Just like in the Carson joke.
Well, what's funny is that Bernstein, in all of his notes that he took about the interviews that he did, he in his notes said MF for, and then when the notes became public and he was questioned about it, he said it stood for my friend. And then later on was like, boy, I wasn't very good at tradecraft.
It's funny to imagine, like, if he's just writing Mother Effer, like Mother Effer says the committee to reelect is right. corrupt. Mother Effer says follow the money.
The movie did Deep Throat was ultimately ruled obscene in 1973.
By all its viewers.
By all its viewers. By Ebert, and then everybody followed suit. Judge Joel Tyler, who ruled it obscene, described it as a feast of carrion and squalor.
Is that the definition of obscenity?
Yeah, and the anything
that's a feast of carrion and squalor is illegal. Oh, man.
But in December of 72, Behind the Green Door, starring Marilyn Chambers, was released. It was the first film directed by the Mitchell brothers, who were the proprietors of the O'Farrell Theater in San Francisco's Tenderloin.
So just like Andy Warhol, they've got a vertical. They can.
That's right. They have their own theater. They directed Behind the Green Door. And the O'Farrell Theater actually survived until the pandemic.
Huh.
It was a fixture.
Like a dirty theater or just all kinds of alternative stuff?
Well, they had live sex shows in the 70s. I mean, it was a notorious place. And it was there until the year 2000.
2020?
I'm sorry. Until the year 2020. I passed it all the time because in the old days, those were the cheap hotels up the hill and all the clubs were, you know, if you were headed over to the Castro, you had to go right past it.
I thought you were like, I thought you were going to say, I passed it every day as I was walking in from my hotel.
It had a fantastic
to the
sign.
Theater.
And it was a place where a lot of big, because the Mitchell brothers were fixtures on the San Francisco social scene, mm-hmm. you know, kind of friends of celebs, you know, seedier celebs. But Hunter S. Thompson was one of their buddies. He claimed to have worked at the Mitchell Theater sort of incognito in the 80s.
Can you imagine trying to buy a ticket for a dirty movie and it's Hunter S. Thompson?
Hunter S. Thompson.
Selling you your ticket tripping balls.
The sad end to the Mitchell brothers was that Jim Mitchell actually shot his younger brother, Artie, and killed him in 1991.
The Mitchell brothers, whom I just heard of for the first time, killed each other?
Yeah, well, one of
what
them killed the other.
What a roller coaster for me. I guess you can't kill each other. Yeah.
He was in prison until 1997. So, yeah, I guess. Well, no, you could kill each other, I guess.
It's difficult with guns.
And then, finally, the big movie that really, like, capped the golden age of porn was The Devil and Miss Jones, where...
It's a pun. This is what we grew up with, which was like imagined porn movies where the title was a twist on a blockbuster.
Yeah, like Flesh Gordon came out sometime later.
Right.
And The Devil and Miss Jones starred Georgina Spelvin, who was actually a Broadway actress, who went into the film auditioning for a non-speaking, non-sex role. And the director was so taken by her reading, and she was credited with, like, very natural, very kind of, like, the sex in Devil and Miss Jones seemed...
Like, less performative?
Yeah, and like, it was integrated into the plot more completely, and it was a film that was... that was imminently watchable. Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars.
Does Ebert just do nothing but rate porn movies at this point?
Well, no, he's rating all kinds of movies, but we have sort of retconned Ebert into the role of like America's film reviewer.
Even though at the time he was kind of a minor reviewer. Like, really, you want to know what Rex Reed and Gene Shalit thought about The Devil and Miss Jones.
Yeah, but we'll
save that for the full omnibus about Gene Shalit.
He's become our... like, yeah, exactly.
Evan Ons agrees.
He goes back. And can you think of other cultural sort of eminences that have this effect where...
Like retroactive like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, where they were just local broadcasters and now we think of them as titans of their era.
I don't know. It's just for Ebert, he was just, like kind of last man standing, right place at the right time. But yeah, he was just some Chicago kid, right?
But the end of this era...
So the golden age is 72 to
we're 69 to 74 or 5. There's a lot of argument that the golden age of porn continued all the way up until porn movies started being filmed on video.
Oh, right.
And all the way through the 80s.
Isn't this the plot of Boogie Nights?
Yeah.
Video VHS is going to kill porn by getting rid of the artistry.
And there were most porn films were filmed on film, it's why the filmic quality of them is still pretty good, but the actual films are kind of unwatchably bad because a lot of the time they only had a day, maybe 2 days to make the movie. And because setting up shots with a film camera is not as simple as just pointing the camera and turning it on,
right.
They had a limited amount of time to do reshoots, retakes of scenes. So they kind of went with the first scene. Videotape made it easier to make porn, but then increasingly the internet, of course, reduced the need. Videotape reduced the interest in feature length films because you could just fast forward to the part that you wanted to watch.
Right.
Yeah. You didn't have to sit there
on a reel.
Yeah. Watch them kind of have a stilted conversation.
The pizza guy come over.
Yeah. Oh, it turns out the cake he wanted frosted was me. And that fast forward then made porn directors feel like, well, why am I doing all this extra work?
The fast forward button killed porn.
Yeah.
By getting rid of the setup with the plumber or whatever.
And now on the internet, most porn reels are 5 minutes long, because because you can watch a million of them. You can spend all day sitting and watching porn.
I'm sure people do.
But the thing that brought this initial era of porn chic kind of to a close was a man by the name of Marvin Miller, who sent out a mass mailer in Newport Beach, California, just sort of put a mailer that had pictures of all his different wares, including these films, Devil and Miss Jones, but also magazines and stuff. And the mailer arrived at a family-owned restaurant in Newport Beach that goes unnamed. And the son and his mother who run the restaurant were so scandalized by this mailer that they called the police. And the police found Marvin Miller and arrested him for obscenity. And that led to a case, Miller v. California, where he was prosecuted for obscenity. And Miller v. California ended up referring back to these earlier obscenity cases that had sort of formed the basis of what America, you know, how America approached obscenity.
And what happened? Did he get off?
Go ahead.
Was he found guilty?
Go ahead and just say
it. Was he found guilty?
Well, what the court determined in California, and this was reaffirmed by the Supreme Court, became known as the Miller test, which was a sort of three-pronged test of whether or not an article of
is this like media. The solely of prurient interest language? What's the, I can't remember what the language of a Miller test is.
This is the one where the media in question has to meet community standards, which is would a group of a randomly picked group of
what's kind of a blurry target since right. All adult material, you know, the fun of it is that it violates many people's imagined community standards, right?
So community standards, and then is it patently offensive?
Patently.
Which I think gets, into what we think of as the real forbidden zone of bestiality and necrophilia and
that's funny, because I feel like if you're actually going with, you know, Main Street USA, I feel like maybe any pornography would run afoul of the idea of community standards or patently offensive, right?
I think that all comes up against the problem of everyone on Main Street USA is going home and fast-forwarding through the talky bits.
Right.
You find that statistically, porn consumption is across all social strata, across all political...
There's some evidence today that it's more porn per capita, right, in conservative-leaning or religious-leaning parts of the country?
Well, not just more porn per capita, but more what we would think of as transgressive porn. I mean, transgender porn is much more popular in red states than in blue. And all of the kind of, you know, you're often surprised, like blue state porn is like MILFs, like middle-aged women is the top search term, which... You know, I don't see that necessarily out on the street.
I see MILFs out on the street.
Well, I see a lot of MILFs out on the street.
But you're saying you don't see people's trending that way.
You
people's proclivities don't seem to be.
Yeah, no, at knowing a bunch of middle-aged women, I don't think that they, I think that they all object to the fact that they're not considered sex objects.
But it turns out on the internet,
they're just on the wrong side of the.
Unless it's just like the internet's definition of a MILF is like a 26-year-old or something.
Yeah, right.
That might be the problem.
Well, no, I don't think it is. I think there are some characteristics that mark you as a MILF, and it's not being young.
I wouldn't know.
No, you wouldn't. Well, I wouldn't either.
There we go.
I'm busy watching hooves get trimmed. I don't. Oh, that even sounds dirty now.
See, you ruined everything.
Anyway, Mitchell was prosecuted.
Sorry, the third prong.
Oh, and the third prong.
That's the one with the no artistic redeeming.
The third prong is, does it have, or does it lack, serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value? And that's often the defense of these cases, is that they do have merit that is artistic. This was the National Endowment of the Arts dispute, that all this stuff that community standards.
Yeah, of course it's offensive, but it's also a statement on.
That's right.
Insert here.
Its artisticness is derived from its offensiveness.
Yeah. Transgressive nature.
But Miller v. California, and I think also just the sort of bubble of porn chic, porn films continued to be made that attempted to be feature length. The movie Caligula sort of famously was not filmed as a porn film, but because it was produced by Bob Guccione
edited in hardcore scenes.
He came in and
there's a new restoration out now. Did you know this?
Of Caligula that's not porno?
Yeah, like of the original intent of Caligula with Peter O'Toole or whoever.
Right. I think even that would be unwatchable because they were also on cocaine.
I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying somebody is trying to watch the version with more Peter O'Toole and less Peter and less Tool, as it were.
Bring out the director's. I want to see the director's cut of The Devil and Miss Jones.
Wouldn't it be very short, or is it longer?
That's what she said.
And that concludes the golden age of porn. That does conclude the golden age of porn. Mm-hmm. 1975.
It's over. I mean, unless you believe in, you know, Debbie Does Dallas and
that's the videotape era, right?
No, it's before the videotape era, but it is back to porn being porn and not making any kind of serious case that Jack Nicholson is going to be in the front row with Vanessa Redgrave.
I guess we're technically in the outro now, but do you think the bubble popped because there was no...
Sounds so dirty.
the bubble of chic, porn chic collapses because it is kind of sleazy and shabby and it turns out the public's fascination with it is not actually rewarded by any actual glamour?
Well, Andy Warhol said that The Last Tango in Paris was directly inspired by Blue Movie.
Oh, I see.
And Last Tango in Paris then became, that's a mainstream film where the sex does play a subordinate role to the, you know, to the weird transgressive plot.
So porn chic won by taking over mainstream entertainment.
It did, but you took the X out of it because I think after The Devil and Miss Jones made, you know, whatever, or after Deep Throat made $600 million, the subsequent films, and I think The Devil and Miss Jones actually was in the top 10 movies in Variety.
I've seen that.
But after that, I think the residuals or the returns on those films were much more. It became a massive industry. I mean, I think porn is now a trillion-dollar industry worldwide.
But so much of it gets produced that there is no Avatar-sized hit.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, that's all the golden age of porn. Entry 537.10618, certificate number 25369. In the omnibus, thank you for celebrating Valentine's Day with us.
I hope your relationship did survive Valentine's Day and you and your significant other are watching porn together.
If you have time to do anything else on the internet, you could have found us at some point on social media at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, John Roderick. What's your OnlyFans name? I don't even know.
You know, I've been encouraged to start an OnlyFans what are the new ones? The Cameos. And it always feels just like, I don't know, $75 to wish somebody a happy birthday? That doesn't seem like... I mean, it only takes 5 minutes, but I don't know. If there's a ton of demand for either of us to do an OnlyFans or a Cameo...
I think I'll do a Cameo and you'll do an OnlyFans.
There you go.
It's been decided.
There you go.
You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com to complain about this or any of John's shows. Send us physical items to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. We're actually recording this in December, so that we're in our Christmas card era.
Oh, yeah.
Which means viewers are sending us holiday greetings.
Ho, 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 as she said.
Wow. You can tie in anything. The Comistras of Wisconsin, I want to say, sent us their Wizard of Oz-themed holiday card. Thank you. Comistras, they have there's no lion. Oh, no, there is a lion. The baby is Glinda, the good witch, I think. Yeah, that's nice. They have the right number of people for that. And Scarecrow, that's what. Oh, no, wait. There's no witch. Mom is a scarecrow. I spent way too long trying to figure this out.
Go ahead.
There's no witch. They're all the good guys.
Family.
Mom has a pointed hat, but I thought she was a witch. She's a scarecrow.
So who is, how do you have Wizard of Oz without any villains?
It's just a merry walk through the woods on a yellow brick road.
That's what she said.
It's a grass sandwich. The Donahues have a Detroit Lions themed holiday card they wanted to send to us. Tess and Bill foreground their cats. We used to do the thing. I think we have a lot of friends who are now at the age where their kids are cute, but the parents no longer feel cute. So the cards are all the kids.
Yeah.
And at some point, if you don't have kids or once your kids stop being cute, you move on to this.
Yeah, but your cats.
Here are the cats.
I mean, are those cats cute? Rate those cats. Give it a Siskel and Ebert.
I mean, I will do the thing where all dogs are 11s. These are pretty cute cats, though.
Are they?
Yeah, I mean, take a look. You and I are not cat lovers, but those are some.
I mean, I do love cats.
Those are some cute cats. You don't like your cat.
Well, I don't. I can't have cats close to me because I'm allergic. Let's see. I think that the orange cat clearly has a lot of intelligence, but is a little chonk.
What are their names? Pippa and Buster?
Pippa, that right? Buster, Tess, and Bill.
I believe Tess and Bill are the humans. Please don't rate them.
There are four cats here.
Are there four cats?
Yeah. And I think the two kind of mottled cats, one is sort of gray mottled, one is sort of...
Are you not seeing the same cat twice?
Models?
Because I think their envelope said from Tess and Bill. So unless two of the cats are in charge of the Christmas card list.
Does this cat look like this cat? I don't think so. Maybe, though. Maybe.
Do you have cat blindness?
I mean, look, on this one, what appears to be Pippi is wearing a pink collar. Well, anyway, I do think that the gray cat, I mean, they're both pretty chonk, let's be honest. And that's a feature.
Yeah,
I think that's
what you
a feature
want
in a cat. For
you
sure.
Don't want like a live cats are like scary. You're always thinking about all the birds they probably killed.
No, I like these cats, actually. They do seem nice. Oh, wow. These cats, these pictures are taken in front of a white Christmas tree, these two pictures.
Hey.
And the cats are not currently knocking the Christmas tree over, so they seem like great cats.
Maybe it's a photo studio, and they immediately knocked over the tree at home. Mm. Please send us photos of your cats or anything else to the aforementioned. Did I already say the address? P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. You know, I was in that post office the other day. It's still under renovations. But now they have some of the boxes that start with 66, and I'm very confused.
Uh-oh.
Is that where the devil has his P.O. box?
That's the neighbor of the devil.
The devil in Miss Jones's P.O. box?
Neighbor of the beast. I missed the actual joke.
What did you say? The neighbor of the devil?
The neighbor of the devil.
Hidely hodly.
It's the neighbor of the beast.
That's it. So what does that mean? Does that mean that mail from 98166 is now going to our post office?
Sounds like it.
Who will be the brave viewer to try 98166 and see how long it takes to arrive?
Well, what it suggests is that your PO, your mail spot is consolidating.
It's like the nexus of reality. It's starting to conglomerate.
Well, but people are getting put out of work who worked over at 98166.
My guess is they're just renovating 98166.
Oh, that's how it works.
I don't know. And the big layoffs of the Postal Service are not going to begin until...
until the new postmaster.
Later this year, yeah.
Until Elon Musk is made Postmaster General.
It's going to be so efficient, finally, at the post office.
That's right. The Hyperloop.
It turns out the military and the National Park System have been losing money for years.
Is that right? right.
And we can turn this, we can turn all this around.
You know, I think there are pretty clear ways where the military could make money. If I were in just charge extortion? Of the military. Yeah. And my mandate was make money. I'd be like,
I think I'm well equipped.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'm at the Pentagon, I've been losing hundreds of billions of dollars for decades.
Right.
I've got a pretty good stash, you know. I've got a lot of material should I want to become a profit-making enterprise.
I mean, if you think about the world, there are a lot of despots sitting on fat sacks of cash whose military would not even challenge one aircraft carrier.
That's
and
right.
It feels like, wait a minute, how are we letting them get away with that? What is the Sultan of Brunei exactly? Why have we allowed him to...
Because he's on the same sex jets with our billionaires. That's why. Exactly, that's why he gets away with it.
Sex jets.
Everybody just wants a sex jet. Maybe that's why porn declined. The rise of the sex jet.
Well, I think the porn chic probably declined because of that.
Probably a little bit, or whoever had to clean it. You can find Futurelings online just by looking for them. They're everywhere. They're like Waldo.
Mm-hmm.
Look in any crowd and a few Futurelings will pop up.
Mm-hmm.
You can support the show in many ways. Listen to this one with your kids. Write a positive Amazon review of John's sex positive Omnibus After Dark.
That's right.
Or go to patreon.com and do what the viewers of Devil and Miss Jones did and vote with your wallet.
I would say and... go to the Patreon. It's not an or. If you've already written an Amazon review that says John's porn shows are the best thing about Omnibus,
you're not off the hook.
Then go to Patreon and show your support with $1 or $5 rather.
I mean, we appreciate all these gestures, but clearly some gestures are better than others. Patreon.com/Omnibus Project is what keeps the show ticking. And I think I can promise we've done 639 shows that were not about porn.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I can promise that until show 1280, Omnibus will be largely free of hardcore pornography.
Yeah.
That's our promise to you, the customer.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. And obviously, the Devil and Miss Jones was the peak of our civilization. So it's been in decline ever since. But we hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese, and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.